May be seated.
We're here on case 13-0118, Sandra Taylor Jarvis versus First Resolution Investment Corp. et al. For the appellant, we have Mr. Gentry first.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Boyd Gentry on behalf of appellants Cheek Law Office and Perry Hockenberry. I'll be sharing my time today with counsel for the First Resolution defendants. Thank you. And we will reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case presents four important issues. I will focus my time on the first two issues, which concern the statute of limitations. By way of brief background, this is an alleged class action counterclaim against a law firm, one of its attorneys, and its client. The alleged wrongful conduct is the filing of a complaint in the Summit County Common Pleas Court. The first issue for this court is, where did the cause of action accrue for breach of the credit card payment obligation? We urge this court to follow its prior holding in State X. Rel. Hawley versus Industrial Commission from 1940 and apply a place of wrongful conduct test to these facts. In Hawley, this court held that a cause of action arises at the place where the facts creating the necessity for bringing the action occur. In Hawley, there was a suit against the Industrial Commission for failure to hear and decide a claim. The court reasoned that a cause of action arises out of the place where the right and the wrong on which the action is based had occurred. The court focused on the right, which was the relator's claim to have it heard by the Industrial Commission. The alleged wrong in that case was the failure or the omission of the duty to hear the claim. And the relief sought was to have the commission decide the claim and award compensation to the relator. A straightforward application of that reasoning to this case shows that the right asserted in the original complaint was to recover on a credit card account. The wrong suffered was the refusal to pay on the credit card account. The relief sought was to have the defendant, Ms. Jarvis, pay on the account. Each of those were focused in Ohio. Ms. Jarvis has filed a class action counterclaim alleging that Delaware's statute of limitations applied. Ms. Jarvis gets there by arguing that Ohio's borrowing statute determines that we look at where the cause of action accrued, and under her facts, as alleged, she sent her payments to Delaware, and she sent her application to Delaware, and therefore the cause of action accrued in Delaware, and the Court of Appeals below adopted that analysis.
Counsel, what does the record include in terms of the credit card agreement, the contract? What do we have in the record that really shows what happened in Delaware? She says, I sent my payments to Delaware. Is there proof of that in the record, or do you have that as an allegation or as a statement by her?
She signed an affidavit saying that she directed her payments to Delaware. And the terms and conditions that were filed in the trial court were not admissible evidence because there was no testimony establishing those were the credit card terms and conditions for this account. At the time the case was decided, there had been no testimony on that. There was no affidavit establishing what the written contract was. And so the proposition of law that we have set forth on this first issue is, absent some agreement clearly stating otherwise, because as this case moves forward, if it does, there may be or there may not be some later admission by Ms. Jarvis as to whether the terms and conditions found are hers or not. But the locus of the debt in this case was Ohio. She signed her affidavit stating that she was domiciled in Ohio during all of these events when she opened the credit card account.
Who did she owe money to in Ohio?
She owed money when the cause of action was filed to First Resolution.
And where are they located?
Canada.
Okay. And that's because they acquired the rights to the debt?
Correct. They acquired the debt as an assignee. So at the time the suit was filed, that's who she owed the money to.
Okay. And how soon after her default did they acquire the rights, her default to the credit card?
Approximately 3 years.
Approximately
3 years after her default. She defaulted January 1st, 2005. The account was assigned to First Resolution in 2008.
And what's your take on the statute of limitations? 15 years?
The Ohio's limitation should apply. Either it's an unwritten contract, 6 years, or 15 years. At the time this case was filed, those were the choices in Ohio. Ms. Jarvis has argued, and the Court of Appeals decided, that we must use Revised Code 230503, the borrowing statute, to look at where the cause of action accrued and determine that the cause of action accrued in Delaware, really based on two facts: that she sent her application to Delaware and that she had mailed payments to Delaware. What that misses is that payments were not necessarily due in Delaware. The payments could have been made in Ohio at a Chase Bank branch. They could have been made over the internet, sitting from Ms. Jarvis's home or local library. They could have been made over the telephone.
Well, I assume she got a bill in the mail.
Yes. Yes.
And if she put her check in with her check for a payment in with the bill and put it in the envelope they sent her, where would it have gone?
There were some statements which directed the payment to Delaware. There was at least one statement that directed a payment to Illinois. And there lies the crux of the case. If we look at where was the P.O. box located, we might have P.O. box changes throughout the life of an account, even before, you know, pre-default, post-default. The bank may direct P.O. box payments to different P.O. box locations. And so the better test for measuring where was the locus of the debt is to look at where is the person who has breached. And that's what this court looked at in Hawley and again in the Barber v. Rhodes decision. And in the Barber decision, this court actually looked at two different scenarios.
Counsel, I guess I'm trying to simplify this for myself. If a company is in Delaware and they send me a bill in Ohio, and following Justice Pfeiffer there, and they give me an envelope and said, send me your money back to Delaware, isn't that the locus of the debt for that transaction? I know it may change to Illinois and Canada and all that, but for that transaction, isn't Delaware where everything's happening?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because payments aren't made or do not have to be made solely at a P.O. box. If the debtor picks up the telephone, they may talk to a person in another state, not Delaware, not Ohio, or maybe Ohio.
No, I understand, but by my scenario, which I'm trying to figure out how these facts fit, if a company in Delaware sends me a bill and an envelope and says, send me your money to Delaware, isn't that a Delaware transaction?
I would concede that it is if the contract says payments can only be made at Delaware, payments must be made at Delaware, which is what the...
No, I'm past the contract. I'm talking about the transaction. Happened in Delaware, didn't it? In my scenario that I just gave you.
What happened in Delaware was nothing on a breach. No payment was made. The omission occurred in Ohio. The decision to not make the payment occurred in Ohio.
Okay, so when that happened, what did the next statement say?
They said similar things, that you can make the payment. Please call us to make it over the telephone. You can make it at a local branch. It
probably included some charges for late payment. All those calculations,
yes,
are made in Delaware, sent to Ohio.
Yes.
And said, now send us back even more money because you've now caused your rate of interest to go up. You've got late fees, you name it.
Yes. But what this court had focused on in both the Hawley and Barber decisions was not where should the payments have been received, but where was the person or official located who was withholding payment. And in those decisions, the court this court recognized that you look at where is the person making the decision or the omission to withhold payment. And in this case, to adopt the standard that the Court of Appeals has adopted, that we look at a P.O. box.
Well, could your client have, before your client was in Canada, could your client have sued in Delaware?
No. The creditor here, First Resolution, the Assignee, was not permitted to sue in Delaware because of the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, 15 U.S.C. 1692I, says that the cause of action can only be brought where the consumer resides or where the consumer signed a contract. So the only choice to file was in Ohio under federal law. That venue provision controlled. And so what the Court of Appeals says, well, you might have to file suit here, but we're going to look at where is the most substantial relationship. When we're talking about a nationwide or multinational bank, where is that debt injury felt? The Court of Appeals oversimplified that and said, well, it's felt in Delaware, but that's too tricky to then solve on a later basis, because what if you have payments that were made locally? What if some payments were made over the telephone? Then the trial court, under the Court of Appeals analysis, is going to have the burden of analyzing each payment, each monthly invoice.
Well, counsel, stay with that then. Let's say the payment is made over the phone. Wouldn't the payment be made by the person who is receiving the payment, wherever they happen to be sitting at that moment?
Well, that begs the question of where did that payment go? If the payment is made over telephone and the representative is in India and there's a credit card transaction that is run or some other, they give the banking, checking or savings account number, where does that money go? Depends on where the server is. What we've got is a mess waiting for future trial courts to figure out where did the payment go if they were made under certain circumstances. Here, she had the option to make payments in a number of ways. The Court of Appeals said, well, the P.O. box was there. That's where she sent them. And the Court of Appeals ignores the fact that this is a nationwide bank. The injury is felt everywhere. It's too tenuous to say the injury is felt only where the P.O. box was, especially where the P.O. box changes.
Well, doesn't this case arise out of a contract?
Yes.
Where did the contract, where was it made?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Where is the contract? Where was it made?
An offer was made to her in Ohio. She signed an application in Ohio to apply for it.
Why are we talking about where she mails payments?
The Court of Appeals thought that the P.O. box for receiving payments.
Is this some new theory of the Ninth District Court of Appeals that we're going to start filing lawsuits where we send payments out of a contract?
It's the first time I have been able to find.
Pardon me, please.
It's the first time I've been able to find where a court in Ohio is applying the substantial relationship test to a procedural question. What is
it's
the
a contract action?
It is a contract action.
Where did it arise?
In Ohio.
Right.
So it's an Ohio action.
Yes.
And the trial court granted summary judgment, correct?
Correct.
This
it did.
Case,
it did.
Which the Ninth District overturned.
Yes.
And said, send it
and
back.
Both parties move for summary judgment, so there's no facts in issue, right?
Correct.
The question is, which party's entitled to judgment as a matter of law? That's what the law is on summary judgment.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, what's your view on that?
Your Honor, we believe that we are entitled to the summary judgment. Because this cause of action breach occurred in Ohio, and therefore the cause of action accrued in Ohio under the Hawley and Barber decisions. The facts necessitating bringing this action occurred in Ohio. Your Honor,
counsel,
I see that.
If Mr. Lance is going to have any time,
yes.
You should sit down.
Thank you.
Mr. Lance.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court, Kevin Lance on behalf of the First Resolution defendants. I'm here to address the third and fourth, the final two propositions of law. The third proposition of law states a complaint for breach of a credit card contract may pray for a post-judgment interest rate that exceeds the statutory rate when there is evidence suggesting that the parties agreed to the higher rate. My clients are asking this court to continue to apply settled Ohio law that a plaintiff does not need to prove its case at the pleading stage. The court made it clear in the case of York versus Ohio State Highway Patrol, and also certainly Rule 8, with a short and plain statement of fact, anticipates that a plaintiff may not and probably will not have all of the proof necessary at the time the complaint is filed. In this particular case, First Resolution did have a copy of a monthly invoice, a monthly statement sent to Ms. Jarvis. That invoice stated clearly that the annual interest rate was 24.99%. So
was that put in your pleadings? Did you add that, or did you have an exhibit to your pleadings to that effect?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. And we asked in the prayer for 24%. And the Ninth District's decision appears to not only require First Resolution to prove its case in the pleadings, it also respectfully misapprehends what a prayer is. A prayer is simply that, a request for relief. The Ninth District viewed it as First Resolution enunciating its absolute entitlement to interest at a rate of 24%. I don't know many attorneys who believe their prayer is an entitlement. It's just what it says, a prayer, a request to the court to enter judgment on the terms that it puts in the prayer. Does that mean there's an absolute entitlement? Certainly not. And in the case that this court recently decided, the Minster Farmers Co-op case back in 2008, the court did state that a monthly statement alone is insufficient to show that an entitlement to interest in excess of the statutory rate. But the court did not hold that other evidence in addition to a monthly statement could not suffice. In this particular case, we were never able to get to that point. As the record reflects, First Resolution dismissed its complaint after Ms. Jarvis filed her counterclaim. At that point, it no longer was First Resolution's burden to show that they were entitled to 24%. It became Ms. Jarvis's burden to show that she did not have to pay 24%. And as has been discussed, the cardholder agreement, the terms and conditions, were never a part of this record.
Was that dismissal with or without prejudice?
It was without prejudice, Your Honor.
All right. So it just shifted the burden then to Ms. Jarvis.
That's correct.
And was that prior or subsequent? Was subsequent to the summary judgment, or what point was that dismissal made?
It was prior to summary judgment.
And the court granted summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so what is the status of her claim at the moment?
Well, the Ninth District remanded the case and basically reversed all of the trial court's decision on summary judgment, except it did note that the court had not addressed the bona fide error defense in the FDCPA. So it asked the court to review that in the first instance.
Okay, and at the moment then, Mr. Lance, in as much as First Resolution has dismissed its complaint, how are you representing them, and what is your status here, and what are you asking us to do on behalf of your client?
Well, my status as representing First Resolution is to ask the court, obviously, to reverse the decision of the Ninth District. The decision of the Ninth District makes my client potentially liable on remand for violations of the FDCPA. For instance, in the issue that we've been discussing, whether or not a prayer for an amount of interest in excess of the statutory rate is a false, deceptive, or misleading representation, which would make my client liable under the FDCPA.
But that would be subject to a trial court determination, am I right?
That's correct.
Well, how do we affect that on appeal when it hasn't been ruled on in the first instance?
Well, the trial court, in its decision on summary judgment, held that we did not violate the FDCPA by filing a claim out of time or by filing a prayer in excess of the statutory rate.
But my confusion is that the complaint's been dismissed.
Correct.
So what's the effect of a ruling by the trial court on a dismissed complaint?
Well, it was on the counterclaim, Your Honor.
All right. All right.
the counterclaim by Ms. Jarvis that accused my clients of violations of the FDCPA.
The contract that was entered into, we heard earlier the argument that it was entered into in Ohio, but the person involved here signed an application, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that formed the contract?
It formed at least the basis for a contract, at least sufficient to allow us to ask for the 24.99% rate. Also, in addition to that.
But the application went somewhere to be approved by your client's predecessor.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the contract did not form when she signed the application. It formed at a later point when your predecessor received the application and decided to extend credit.
Well, I would disagree to a certain extent, Your Honor. The offer was made by Chase in Ohio. The acceptance was made by Ms. Jarvis in Ohio, and she used the credit card in Ohio, which denotes the contract was made. And you know, our point of view is obviously that the contract was formed in Ohio.
So she was sent a form to sign after Chase didn't do anything after she signed this and sent it back, signed it and sent it back, and she was good to go, or they didn't do any evaluation or anything?
Chase extended credit based upon Ms. Jarvis's acceptance of their offer.
They didn't do a credit check, or?
I don't know, Your Honor. I would imagine that's fairly standard procedure.
They just shotgun out these applications, you sign it and send it in, and you're good to go. Is that the way it works?
I'm sure there was a credit review, Your Honor.
So the contract then wasn't formed when she signed the application?
Well.
Was it?
We believe that it was, Your Honor. We just respectfully disagree. Of course, there is no terms and agreement of any contract in the record, which might help to answer that question.
Thank you. Mr. Burke.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. I'm Jim Burke. My partner, John Horgan, and I represent Sandra Taylor Jarvis. Justice Pfeiffer asked, where was the contract made? The contract was clearly made in Delaware, Your Honor, because Chase sent an invitation to make an offer to Sandra Jarvis in Ohio. Actually, Chase didn't send it. Chase is a second bank that's involved in this particular credit card issuance. As we set forth in our brief, this credit card was initially issued by First USA, a Delaware corporation. They're the ones who sent the invitation to make an offer. Sandra signed the offer in Cuyahoga Falls and mailed it back to Delaware. The record is exceedingly clear on that. The Court of Appeals, at paragraph 27 of its opinion, noted, and I quote, the evidence demonstrates that Ms. Jarvis sent her credit card invitation to Delaware and that her offer was accepted in Delaware, thereby creating a contract in Delaware.
Was the contract ever presented in evidence? Did it ever say this contract will be governed by the laws of either Delaware or Ohio?
No, no one has a copy of the contract, Your Honor. There is no written contract. However, there are invoices, and I want to direct the court's attention to supplement at page 474 and 475. And I'm going to try to read this fine print on the back of that invoice, at supplement page 475.
That invoice or monthly statement? What are
monthly
you reading?
Monthly statement, okay. Your Honor. It's a monthly statement, and it indicates that she's supposed to make her payments. The payment address is Post Office Box so-and-so, Wilmington, Delaware. Now, the back of the statement says, for payments by regular U.S. mail, send at least your minimum payment to our Post Office Box box designated for payment shown in this statement. Your payment by mail must comply with the instructions on this statement and must be made by check or money order payable in U.S. dollars, drawn upon or payable through a U.S. financial institution in the, or the United States branch of a foreign financial institution. Do not send cash. Write your account number on your check or money order. Payments must be accompanied by the payment coupon in the envelope provided with our address, visible through the envelope window. The envelope cannot contain more than one payment or coupon.
You've only got a few minutes here, Mr. Burke. Let me get to an issue. Suppose that said mail it to India.
Well, I would have would, to say based on
you say,
this, I would say based on the decision of this court in Meekeson, which is a 1950 Supreme Court decision that we cited in our brief, that in fact the cause of action would have arise in India.
So wherever you mail a payment is now the situs of where the contract is formed, and that's the...
No, I don't say that that's where the contract was formed, although the contract in this case was formed in Delaware. But I do say the cause of action accrues in Delaware or India, and I'll explain why. In Meekeson, Michigan residents signed a note in Michigan. They received cash in Michigan. They used the cash in Michigan. And they were supposed to make a payment on a certain date in Napoleon, Ohio. Naturally, they didn't make the payment. Eventually, the note holder's assignee sued the Michigan makers and said, "You owe the money." And the Michigan makers came into Ohio and argued under Ohio's then existing borrowing statute that the cause of action accrued in Michigan.
Counsel, I guess what you're describing is the place of wrongful conduct.
Correct.
At that point. That's precisely what you're talking about. And couldn't an argument be made in this case that the wrongful conduct was entering into a contract, taking money and spending money, all of which happened in Ohio?
There is no evidence whatsoever where Sandra Jarvis spent the money. They admitted, in the record, they admitted that they have no idea how she used the money. The Court of Appeals found that there was absolutely no evidence that the Court of Appeals of paragraph 26 said defendants didn't present any evidence to demonstrate where Ms. Jarvis primarily used her card, that she was in Ohio at the moment she decided not to pay the amounts, or that she could have made her payments in any way but by check to the payment address in Wilmington, Delaware.
Counsel, again, I want to clarify your answer to Justice Lansinger. You're saying that in this case we do not have the contract?
We do not have a written agreement. We have evidence of the contract. We not only have Sandra saying—
Hey, slow down. We do or do not have a contract?
We obviously have a contract, Your Honor, because we couldn't be sued if there was no breach of a contract. That's what the suit's about.
Can
they
I read it?
For breach
Counsel,
of contract.
Can I read it?
No, it's not written. But you can see, if you want to know what the intent of the
So you're saying we have a contract that I can't read. So is it an oral contract?
Yes, if it's not written, it's oral. What else could it be?
You have a written contract that nobody produced.
Correct.
Okay. That was a pretty simple answer.
Okay.
All right.
We don't have any evidence of the written contract.
And you say there's no evidence that she used her credit card in Ohio.
That is correct. They admitted that they have no idea where she used her credit card, and I'll refer you to their response.
Did she live in Ohio since the time that she received the credit card when was it, 2003 that she received her credit card?
I believe it was 2001, Your Honor.
2001, okay. Did she live in Ohio in 2001?
Yes, she did.
Okay. And actually, they sent her a card in the mail to her home address, correct?
That is correct.
All right. And until she used that credit card, she owed them nothing.
That is right.
Okay. And once she used it, she kind of seals the deal that this is a contract in which I am going to enter.
They gave her credit before she used the card, yes.
If she doesn't use their credit, she owes them nothing.
I agree with that.
That is, you know, has no force or effect. They couldn't have sued her. She didn't owe them anything. But until she used that credit card, once she used that credit card, she triggers the activation of the contract.
Yes, and there's no breach at that point. The only breach occurs, like the court in Mickelson said, was when she defaults. When she fails to do that's what she's supposed to do.
I'm looking at the activation of the contract, and you'd like to say that the activation of that contract took place in Delaware.
No, I say the contract was formed in Delaware when the bank agreed to extend credit to her and sent her the credit card. Now, that doesn't mean that she was liable for anything, but the contract was formed at that point.
And she doesn't agree until she uses the credit card.
Well, Judge, wait a minute. If I enter into a line of credit with my bank on my house, we sign a written agreement, okay? There is a written agreement made at some point in time. Now, it could be years later that I draw down on that line of credit. Sure, I activate the credit at that point, but you're going to ask me where the contract was formed? The contract was formed when I signed the papers with the bank. So if the bank was in Bangladesh, and I sent the papers back to Bangladesh, they made an offer, the contract was made in Bangladesh. Now, the fact that I may activate or create a liability by drawing funds down, that's separate from where the contract was formed.
Let me ask you two other questions quickly here, because I don't want you to run out of time, Mr. Burke. There's a claim about post-judgment interest exceeding the statutory rate.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then there's an additional issue about whether or not this is a consumer transaction, which would render liability under the Consumer Sales Practice Act. Would you address those two propositions,
yes,
please?
Let's address proposition number three, which is the excess interest claim. The argument that the appellants are asserting is that they merely filed a complaint and this triggered all this liability. Well, that's not what happened in this case. They filed a complaint. They knew, when the complaint itself says, we don't have a copy of the written agreement. They even say, we weren't the original creditor, so we don't have it, and it may already have been destroyed. Secondly, when they bought the debt, they didn't buy it from Chase, they bought it from another debt buyer. That debt buyer informed them in writing that the maximum rate of interest that could be charged on this account was 5%. And that's at, supplement page 604, 727, and 831, 5%. Then their own internal manual.
What's the basis of the 5%?
Well, I assume it was 5% was the statutory rate at the time that they were selling the claim in 09, 08, okay.
But Mr. Land said they attached a copy of something support.
Yes, they did. They attached a copy of this invoice, the one that I referred to at supplement 474 and 475. That's the document they attached. They also attached some bills of sale showing that Chase had sold to Unifund, and then some other Unifund operation, Unifund CCR, sold to Frick, to First Resolution Investment Corporation. The second thing, Your Honor, though, is their own internal manual says that if you don't have complete documentation and you bring a cause of action on a credit card in Ohio, you are limited to 10% interest, and you're not entitled to any attorney fees. And that, Your Honor, is located in their manual.
Counsel, isn't that something, if this got to a trial, that would have been resolved? I guess from what I heard from opposing counsel, that the ask for the 24% is what is deemed to be some kind of violation here.
They didn't just ask, Judge. They had their own manual, then they prepared a journal entry. They took a default judgment
for 24% interest, knowing that they had no written agreement, that they were limited to 5%, and their own internal manual said 10. They took the judgment. Why? The business that they're in is in default judgments. These are debt buyers. 90% of the cases end up in defaults, and they know it. They preyed on both the trial court, because it's busy, just sign the thing and move on, and the debtor. What did we then have to do? They didn't just file a complaint. I had to go in and file a 60B motion to get that judgment vacated. Did they dismiss their case then? No, they hung on to their case. The only time they dismissed their case was when we file a class action counterclaim. Then all of a sudden they're prepared to dismiss without prejudice. So, Your Honor, what we have here is we have a case under section 1692F1. That statute says that it is improper to attempt to collect any amount, including interest, unless you have the agreement that creates the debt or it is otherwise permissible under law. We don't have the written agreement, so it has to be otherwise permissible under law. Well, Minister Finance says that you have to have a written agreement to get interest in excess of the statutory rate.
So because the contract is not in evidence, your position is they're not entitled to the 24.99% interest rate.
That is correct.
And what? Had the document been attached, you would have a totally different argument.
That is absolutely correct, because that's what Minister Finance teaches. It teaches us that an invoice is irrelevant.
So
that's essentially what it says in terms of determining whether the mandates of 1343A.
What is the status of your class action as you sit here today?
The trial judge has deferred ruling on any class issues and just dealt with summary judgment.
And the summary judgment has been granted in this instance.
And reversed by the Court of Appeals.
And what is it you're asking us to do then in connection with this post-judgment interest on the statutory rate case?
Affirm the decision of the Ninth District in all respects, because one, the statute of limitations is in fact 3 years under Delaware law, the cause of action accrued in Delaware. Two, affirm the decision that seeking 24% post-judgment interest, yes, not just seeking it in a complaint, all the facts.
Well, I thought that complaint had been dismissed.
It was. They dismissed it. We said the very...
Well, that, just is that an issue then for us?
Yes, it is, because the taking of the judgment violated the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
So the taking of the judgment that has been vacated and dismissed is the culpable act that you're...
Well, I won't say just one thing. It's the filing of the complaint.
Yes.
It's the taking, it's the presenting of not all the facts to the trial court with a journal entry. It's the taking of a default judgment. It's forcing us to file a 60B. All those facts are the reason that we're entitled to a judgment under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act for their claim for excess interest.
And then would you kindly address in your closing moments the consumer sales protection issue on the fourth proposition of law?
Yes, Your Honor. Very briefly, I think the Attorney General's brief on this subject is most persuasive. This case is not just about the filing of a complaint. They sent letters, which are in the record, threatening to sue her and also demanding 24% interest, okay? What happened here, unlike the Barclay Bank case, what we have here is we don't have some third party that's working for the bank. The bank sold its claim to debt buyer one, and debt buyer two is the one that's here in this courtroom. Debt buyer two, acting on its own behalf, sent letters to Sandra Jarvis. And basically what these letters are is demands and let's make a deal. Now, I'm sorry, when you're dealing directly with the consumer and you're suggesting we have some kind of a transaction, I think there is a consumer transaction. And that's essentially what the position of the Attorney General.
Is there any case authority you have that a consumer sales transaction occurs when when the collection ensues?
Yes, Your Honor, and we cited them in our brief. There's a whole series of cases. They're cited at page 50 of our brief.
All right, thank you.
Yes. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Gentry, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you. One quick point. It's the issuance and use of the credit card that creates the legally binding agreement. That was held in Bank One v. Palmer, 63 Ohio at 3rd, 491.
Right, counsel, the 24%, would you agree that the rate, even if there is jurisdiction here in Ohio, is 10%?
For the statutory rate, but under a contract.
But you don't have any contract to produce to show us what the 24.99% rate applies here.
Correct. We have no written contract in the record. What the law firm had at the time of filing the complaint was the monthly statement, which is not the contract, but evidence of what the contract was. Something that satisfies Rule 11 for the law firm to say, this is how much is owed, this is how much the interest rate was. And so the question is, can the law firm even pray for that? Or does the law firm first have to have all of the written evidence tied up in a bow? That was what the Harvey Court dealt with from the Sixth Circuit under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And the Sixth Circuit said the law firm does not need to have every document entitled to make sure it's going to win.
Let's move on to the default judgment entry that you received here and inserted the 24% interest rate on. And that's the allegation here, that somehow you pulled a fast one on the trial judge by doing that and it wasn't caught.
Correct. The allegation is our communications with the court are somehow violating consumer statutes because we have some evidence of a 24.99% interest rate. No answer from the defendant to the complaint.
So the default, the fact that there was no answer doesn't place a burden on you to produce verification of that 24%.
Correct. The burden is not on us. The burden has not been on us, on the appellants, to produce a written contract or to prove that any amount of interest was eventually going to be awarded on a trial that didn't happen. The burden was on Ms. Jarvis, the appellee, to say that was illegal and you knew it was illegal at the time you did it. And clearly, what we have is the evidence the law firm had was the contract monthly statement showing that there was a contract somewhere behind it.
That is sufficient in light of the fact that you don't have the actual agreement that would allow you for the 24% on the judgment entry.
Yes. Yes.
And even though the Minster case was already announced by this court, there was no duty to find out what Ohio law was on the subject?
Well, what the monthly statement is not the contract, but evidence of the contract. And what the Harvey Court recognized from the Sixth Circuit, when we're looking at this in the context that it is, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, there's no duty under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act to make sure that you have all of the evidence that can be obtained through discovery in the case before you file your complaint.
But don't you have to check what the law is of your jurisdiction? I mean, if you're filing the default and you know that you're limited to a statutory rate of 10% and the court has ruled that that's the case, isn't that a necessary part of being fair to the court in terms of what the law, what you're seeking and what you're presenting as your default judgment?
Yes, of course it's necessary to know what the law is and to be fair to the court. Here, the allegation is not that we had somehow duped the court. The court is not the plaintiff. The allegation is we somehow harmed Ms. Jarvis by filing pleadings.
But Mr. Gentry, this comes up on a matter of summary judgment. And it occurs to me that there's all sorts of factual questions as to where this contract arose, what documents we should look at to determine it, whether or not we're going to use a mailbox address as a situs of a contract, questions with respect to the amount of interest, if any, that's due, what that rate is, and the application of the Consumer Sales Practice Act. So how does this get up on a summary judgment when it shouldn't be granted unless there's any no material genuine issues of material fact?
There were no issues of fact. There was no disagreement about these facts.
No genuine issue of material fact about any of these issues? Is that what you're telling us?
But there were no two sets of facts below.
Pardon me?
There were no two sets of facts below. There was only one set of facts below.
This is because of a default.
Mm-hmm. No. The default was vacated, Your Honor.
Okay.
The default was vacated, and discovery was had. And at the conclusion, when we're filing motions for summary judgment, that is the record. That is the evidence. And there were not disagreements about any of these things. The only disagreement is what do these facts mean.
Just from my cursory review of what's going on here, there are some genuine issues of material fact.
There are questions that Ms. Jarvis has that she can't answer for herself, but that does not mean there are questions in the record, such as competing evidence. The evidence is what it is in the record, and it's not going to change when it goes back.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you, gentlemen.